Welcome to Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shurtleff. This show is heard on WBCQ every Tuesday night. The times were changed recently. Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, 7:30 Eastern Standard Time, and also on Friday nights, 7:30 Eastern Standard Time. I just go to the website, WBCQ, to be sure when they, I guess they changed this recently, and I'm delighted they gave us another half hour. You can also hear this show on podomatic.com. Just punch in, go to the website and punch in Camp Constitution, and our show would pop up. Usually we put them up about once a week. And we also have some other classic interviews going back from the 70s and 80s of very interesting and informative individuals. You can also hear the show on IPM Nation, which is aired, and they do change the times for that too. IPMNation.org is a 24-hour online service based out of Concord, so just go online and look at their programming too. I think it's Saturdays at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, but they do they have changed that. And you can also see us on YouTube, Camp Constitution's YouTube channel. We generally, within a week or so, we post these shows up on our YouTube channel. So welcome again, and I'm going solo today. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Constitution. We were named after the Constitution, and sometimes we discuss issues that aren't specifically dealing with the Constitution, but obviously everything, every issue is somehow related to the Constitution, either directly or indirectly, and usually it's a case of not adhering to it. But a few things. One of them is the Electoral College, and we were very blessed the Electoral College, it works very well. Now, I was doing a little research and brushing up on some facts and figures just a few days ago, and I came across this website called debates.com, and I don't know the demographics, if it's young people, old people, the general public, college students, or what, but should the Electoral College be abolished was the question, and only 13% of the people said that it shouldn't be abolished. Now, the founders, when they gave us the Constitution, they debated the office of the executive. Under the Articles of Confederation, you had a president of the Congress, but you didn't have an executive branch. So that was something unique. And then there was questions of how will this person be chosen, or persons. There was a few proposals to have several members of the executive branch. And one of the proposals was that the Congress would choose the president. And they thought, well, no, that would mean the president would be too beholden to Congress. There wouldn't be any independence. And it was one proposal to have a popular election. And it was Elbridge Gerry that said, absolutely not. That's the last thing you want, is to have a popular election. So there was various things they threw out, and then they came up with the Electoral College, and it wasn't called the Electoral College at that point. But the idea is that states with small populations would have some say. Today, if we were to abolish the Electoral College, we would have New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago pretty much run the country. And I don't think most people want to. I should say that it's not in the best interest of the country, definitely. So states with small populations still have some say, and you got a state like New York. I think they've got over 40 electoral votes, and it's based on the number of members of the House and Senate. That's that simple. So the voters, so when you actually vote in the general election, you're actually voting for electoral voters who then will, I think it's the whatever second or third Tuesday, they meet in their state houses and cast a vote. And even though there might be laws in some states that say they have to pretty much go along with the popular vote, they don't necessarily have to do that. So I think it worked out very well. Now, there's been some examples where the electoral votes and the popular votes don't reflect each other. This past election, that was the case. I think there was with Bush, with one of Bush's elections, this would be Bush the younger. But it works out very well. And it's almost as if the state of Massachusetts, moderately sized state, We have, I think we have 11 electoral votes. You know, a state like Maine, you have four. But with Maine, they actually have something a little unique. It's not winner take all. And I actually think if there's any reforming, and it doesn't have to be done, you don't have to change the Constitution. The states can simply just, I would say it should be by congressional seats. So if the voters in one particular congressional district support a candidate, that electoral vote should go. And I think there's another state that has a little bit of a split. And that used to be the way, and then they decided winner take all. So there are states where you know these what they call blue states. They really should be called red states, as it reflects the red socialist philosophy. But the states like Massachusetts, although Ronald Reagan carried Massachusetts in 1980, it may have been the last time a Republican candidate carried the state. And you know, Trump got his good share of votes, but not nearly enough to ever win. And it's probably not going to be that way for a long time. So my vote doesn't really count when it comes to presidential election. The votes of people who are conservative Republicans, but maybe in certain districts. And if you looked at a map, a political map of who voted for whom in Massachusetts, there were a lot of towns that supported Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton, but they didn't get any electoral votes. So that would be my one change I would recommend, is that states go to, you know, not winner take all, but go by congressional district. Or they could even create districts, electoral districts. But anyway, I think it's something we should keep. And it's also, we should keep in mind that the president was never supposed to be an all-powerful person. The executive branch was not supposed to be where most of the power comes from. You know, George Washington had, I think, three or four cabinet members. You know, he had a Secretary of Defense, Secretary of War, Secretary of State, Secretary of the Treasury, and I don't know if there was any others, three or four at the most. Today, there's 23 cabinet-level secretaries, and I think most of these things should be abolished. And so I also want to talk a little bit about the 25th Amendment. And I did a Facebook video a couple of weeks ago. Now, it's interesting. And here, by the way, I want to qualify it. I'm not here as a spokesman for Camp Constitution supporting or endorsing candidates. But I think it's important to point out that the venom that the left has for our current president, Donald J. Trump, he was never supposed to get beyond probably New Hampshire in the primaries. He beat all of the other contenders and became the Republican nominee. This was to the chagrin of the establishment Republicans. They figured there's no way he would ever beat any Democrat. The Democrats chose the worst possible candidate they could find. I mean, if they had to look around and say, who was the worst person to run for Hillary Clinton. They made big mistake. That was a big mistake they made. So if anyone has to blame, put the blame on somebody. Don't blame it on a talk show host. Don't blame it on the radical right or what have you. You gotta blame it on your own party, folks. You nominate a really dirty candidate, and a lot of Democrats, more than enough to make a difference, just couldn't pull a lever for her. So that's what and a lot of the Republican establishment people despised Trump. They hated him, and they figured, well, we're not going to win the seat. Hillary will win. And we'll be the loyal opposition, and we'll support her candidates, we'll support her Supreme Court nominees, and so forth and so on. Oh, well, so Trump wins the election, and the first thing was, well, we have to influence electoral voters. Maybe we have a chance of stopping Trump, and they just won't cast their vote, and they'll have to take the vote up in the House. And under the Constitution, if the electoral voters don't choose somebody, the election goes into the House, and they choose the House and the Senate. And I won't go into the specifics, but anyway, that happened with John Quincy Adams in the election. I think it was 1824, where the vote went into the House. The House chooses the president, and the Senate chooses the vice president. And I think with the House, if I recall, each state votes for each state, a vote in the state is for one vote. So, and again, it doesn't. That's something they were trying to hope that would happen, and that didn't happen. Then it was the Russian Putin-Trump scandal. Oh yes, Trump was collaborating with Putin to throw the election and so forth. And of course, that was just a conspiracy theory. Now, in the last couple of weeks, we have to invoke the 25th Amendment. Donald Trump is obviously, because he says put America first, and that we want to build this country, create jobs and so forth, reduce the regulations, he must be nuts. Because nobody, no president, no sitting president can actually believe that America should come first. So they figured he's crazy. So we have to invoke the 25th Amendment. Now, let me just go over that a little bit, because it has nothing to do with necessarily someone being insane. The 25th Amendment became part of the Constitution in 1967. Now, the Constitution had a few things in it. The founders were very good about creating a ways to amend the Constitution to fix defects. And by the way, an Article 5 convention was not to revamp the Constitution. It was to fix defects. So let me read it. In case of the removal of the president from office or of his death or resignation, the vice president shall become president. Now, that was the case in the past. Okay. Whenever there is a vacancy in the office of the vice president, the president shall nominate a vice president who shall take office upon confirmation of a majority of votes of both houses of Congress. Now, we've had some vacancies in the office of vice president, and for the longest time, there was no way to replace that person. We had two vice presidents early on. I think it was one of Madison's and one of Monroe's vice presidents. In fact, Elbert Gerry, I believe, died while he was vice president. And there was another one. And then you had William King, who was Franklin Pierce's vice president. He actually died. He took his oath of office in Cuba, came back to the United States, and died. And so for his 4 years, there was no vice president. No, there is a means, a Secession of Powers Act that the Constitution grants to Congress. So they could have, if the president was to be disabled or died, there would be a way to replace him, but there'd be no vice president. And then you had the assassination of John Kennedy. Johnson becomes president, and there's no vice president. And that also happened with McKinley and others. So the vice president becomes president, but there's no way to have a vice president. So that took care of that problem. And I think it was that part of the Constitution was good. I think that was good. And also, Section 3 is the critical thing here in Section 4. And it can be a little confusing. So I'll kind of discuss it and, read it and then go to discuss it. Whenever the president transmits to the president pro temp of the Senate, this would be the speaker, the president of the Senate is the vice president. He only votes, or she maybe, only votes if there's a tie. And at one point, they used to actually run the Senate. John Adams would kind of run the show in the Senate. At some point, they stopped doing that, I guess when they created golf courses. And I don't know the exact year about that, but so vice presidents do cast a vote only in case of a tie. And they're very, very rarely will you see them in addressing the Senate. So whenever the president transmits to the president pro temp of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives his written declaration that he is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, and until he transmits to them a written declaration to the contrary, such powers and duties shall be discharged by the vice president as acting president. So the president, maybe he's going over some chemotherapy. Maybe he's got some kind of horrible disease he's being treated for. Or maybe he's got some crisis in his immediate family. Now, this has never happened, but these are possibilities. So he would transmit this, and the vice president becomes the acting president. So the vice president does not become the president, but the acting president, which is different than when a president dies. And vice president now becomes the president. Okay. Whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments, and there are 23 at this point, or of such other body as Congress may by law provide, and I don't think they've done that. I may be wrong, but I don't think they've made a law that another body of people will have a say in whether or not the president is disabled. transmit to the President pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives their written declaration that the President is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. The Vice President shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office of acting President. So, but let's say the President had a stroke and was in a coma. We don't know the prognosis. President was incapacitated. That would be sort of a no-brainer. No one's suggesting if a president has a heart attack or is in a coma, he cannot physically transmit that he's no longer able to carry the duties. But the members of the cabinet will say, yep, president's going to be out of commission indefinitely. So then we get back that we get here. Thereafter, when the president transmits to the president pro temp of the Senate and the Speaker of the House his written declaration that no inability exists, he shall resume the powers and duties of his office, unless the Vice President and the majority of either the principal officers of the Executive Department or of such other body as Congress may by law provide, but again, I don't think they've done that, transmit within 4 days to the President pro temp of the Senate and the Speaker of the House their written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. Thereupon, Congress shall decide the issue. So the president says, no, folks, I'm fine. Everything's good. I got a clean bill of health. I'm competent and capable of doing my job. So then the majority of cabinet members, in this case, it's going to be 12, I believe. I think there's 23, as I mentioned. So there's going to be 12 people or more to say no. The Prez is not able to do it. Then Congress has to make the decision. And this is really tough. This is really a tough thing. And they've got, so, like I say, 4 days to make the. So here we go. The Speaker of the House, in the written declaration that no bill exists, he shall resume the powers and duties of his office unless the Vice President. All right, now we're getting down to Congress shall decide the issue, assembling within 48 hours for that purpose, if not in session. If the Congress within 21 days after the receipt of the latter written declaration, or if Congress is not in session within 21 days after Congress is required to reassemble, determines by two-thirds vote of both houses that the President is unable to discharge the powers and duties of office, the Vice President shall continue to discharge the same as acting President. Otherwise, the president shall resume the powers and duties of his office. So they are really stretching him. It's really difficult. Again, if it was a slam dunk, if the president was in a coma, or if there was some real serious issue here. But so now you need to have a majority of the cabinet members. That would be 12 or more, but I think at least 12. They have to say, well, no, president says he's fit, but he is not fit. And we think the guy has got some issues and shouldn't be president. Then Congress decides, but it's got to be two-thirds of Congress. That is really difficult, and that's why that two-thirds is a great fraction. Two-thirds of, to pass a treaty, two-thirds of the states to pass a Article 5, call for an Article 5 convention application. So this is good. Two-thirds to expel a member of the House or the Senate, and two-thirds to determine whether or not the president is capable and competent. So this is a good lesson in the Constitution. And it's interesting, too, that people on the left who talk about the Constitution being obsolete, being old, being something from a – what was the term they use? A Eurocentric – white Eurocentric dead white males. That's right, from dead white males. All of a sudden, when they put it to their advantage, or when they think they can be used to their advantage, they become staunch constitutionalists. You know, like the flag issue we have in Boston, where we want to raise a Christian flag, and all it is just a white field, a little blue corner, which I forget what they call it, and a red cross. That somehow is a violation of the First Amendment, which they probably never read, but they become constitutionalists when it comes to the. They want to abolish the Electoral College, but they wanted to use electoral voters to vote for somebody else, you see. So it's kind of interesting how they can use the Constitution when it's to their advantage. The Constitution is not for any one group of people. It's not for the left or for the right. It's not for conservatives, Democrats, Republicans. It's for all of the people. And that's how important the Constitution is. And I think the 25th Amendment is something that is a good amendment. I think we needed to have a way to replace a vice president. And yes, it's possible that a president can become incapacitated. And it's also possible that that president doesn't think he's incapacitated. And let's hope that it never happens. And that's one thing, too, the founders gave us. They gave us frequent elections. And they gave us a balance of powers. It's not like a scale, like this group has so much and that group has so much and everything's in balance. It really isn't that way at all. People talk about a balance of powers. Basically, it's this. As James Madison said, the powers granted to the federal government, it might be a paraphrase, are few and defined. And where do we find these powers? Well, in Article 1, we find the powers that Congress is granted. Mostly in the Article 1, Section 8. In 7, it talks about how a bill is made and how Congress votes on bills and so forth. And, of course, the House has the power of impeachment, which is addressed in Article 2 of the Constitution. But most of the powers, and I think there's something like 28 of them spelled out altogether, maybe a few more, a few less. And this is pretty much all you can do, folks. And you're up for election if you're a member of the House every 2 years. If you're in the Senate, one-third is up for election every 2 years. So you can have a complete change of the House every 2 years and one-third, and within 6 years, a whole new Senate. You see, if the voters were informed, if they understood the Constitution, if they abided by the Constitution, if we encouraged or demanded that our elected officials abide by the Constitution. And unfortunately, that's why we're in the mess we're in. It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It's not a political party obviously parties are a certain part of the problem, but they're a problem only because the people who vote for these folks, we keep on sending the bad, or some cases we replace a bad member of the House or a bad member of the Senate with a new congressman or a new senator who's equally as bad. And this is the idea of term limits, you see. We have a lot of people coming to Congress, and they're not doing their job. So if we simply limited their terms with an amendment, that's going to be a panacea. That's going to create members of Congress who won't violate their oath of office. Well, that's very interesting. I wish it were that simple. And, of course, there's a call. There's applications around the states to have a Article 5 convention for the only purpose of having term limits. Well, according to the Congressional Research report, I think it was done in last year or 2 years ago, they looked at members of Congress, the current members of Congress, and they said the average term is 9.1 years. The proposed amendment, or there might be a few with variations, but I believe that all of the amendments that I've seen proposed amendments are calling for 2 6-year terms for the House, I'm sorry, for the Senate, and 6 2-year terms for the members of the House. So that's 12 years. So if we have a convention, and if they only adhere, which is almost impossible to happen, but they only adhere to that one issue, and they pass a balanced budget amendment at this convention, then it goes to the states, and it might take another 2 years, 3 years, or maybe even less. But so right now, let's just say 2 years before the amendments will even be on the book. So the amendment will be on the book. Then it's going to take 12 years for it to actually kick in. So 14 years from now, 15 years maybe, there may be a chance that those bad members of Congress can get kicked out. Well, I just mentioned that the average congressman serves 9.1 years. So it's really a redundancy here. You've already accomplished that. But what you've done is now you've limited the terms of some of the good guys. You've also said to the voter that we're going to restrict your freedoms. You know, you can't vote for this person. Maybe that person's been there for six terms, and they're doing a great job. And, you know, they're seasoned, and why not stay there? In other cases, they're doing a bad job. They should be voted out as soon as possible. Not six terms, but one term. And you see, so that's where the term limit should be. It should be at the ballot box. And I know that a lot of them have war chests and lots of money, and that's probably why it's some of these people are doing that. But we've seen some great results. And all the PAC money, in spite of PAC money, in spite of the franking privileges that these people have, if you don't like your member of Congress, well, you're going to get rid of them. And we've seen that happen. I think it was James Madison that used the term disquietude of the people. You know, and that's what one thing about the social media and the alternative, I don't mean the alt-right, but the alternative media, you know, we can get out voting records of members of the House. Hard to do before the advent of this wonderful internet. I mean, you had to publish the records and distribute them door to door or, you know, at gatherings. It was not an easy thing to do. But today, you can, you're an informed citizen. How did my congressman vote? Bingo. I go to the newamerican.org, the Freedom Index. That's one place. There's others, you know. Say, hey, okay, this is how this person votes. My goodness. Oh, he's voting 20% of the time for limited government. I better get the word out, and I perhaps better look for somebody else to fill that slot. And but unfortunately, most people don't pay attention. And I mean, most Americans don't even know who the member of Congress is. And if they do know, they don't know much about that person or how they vote. Or they may know a little bit about that person because that person showed up at your Rotary Club, or that person supports your pet project. Well, maybe that person has the one issue that you like, and because of that one issue, you're going to support that person no matter what. And you look at the voting record and say, my goodness, I didn't know all that. And I've met people all the time. I've had people in Vermont. They thought Bernie Sanders was a great supporter of the Second Amendment, you know. And I said, well, yeah, when he was a senator, when he's a senator, and before that he was a congressman, I said, but look at the rest of it. You say, you guys, he's running you into the ground. He's destroying your, you know, all the votes he's taking are bad votes, except for a couple that deal with that. And you can't replace him with someone who's going to not only support the Second Amendment, but the rest of the Constitution, too. And it's just amazing. And people couldn't believe that he was voting this way. In fact, using that Freedom Index, there was something that we used to call the Sandinista Index. And you look at his voting record, and it's usually between a 25 and a 30%, meaning he voted for big government 75% of the time, but you see Republicans and Democrats that are to the left of Bernie Sanders, and that can be a little scary here. So anyway, well, we only got a couple of minutes left, so I encourage you folks to, you know, the U.S. Constitution, you can go online and find it, and there's free courses, Hillsdale, and if you go to our YouTube channel, and you look at our classes that we have online on the Constitution over the last 7 or 8 years, you'll get more information than you'll need. We have some great constitutional scholars at our camp teaching classes on the Constitution, Chris Ann Hall. So please visit our YouTube channel, and you can go to Chris Ann Hall and go to her website and get some really good insight on the Constitution and have an understanding. I was just interviewed by a good friend of ours, Chuck Morse, you know, on getting a constitutional mindset. Read the Constitution. And it was written in the U.S., it was written in English. And, you know, there are some archaic terms here and there, but, you know, an online dictionary will cure that problem, you know, like the term well regulated. Well, today, it's either somebody who has a good circulatory, not system, but someone who's, system is working clearly, I guess, or something that's regulated, a lot of laws and rules against it. Well, actually, it meant that militia was trained, well regulated, well trained. In other words, you wanted a militia to make sure that they know how they can get the job done. And that's what it meant. It had nothing to do with a bunch of, and there are rules and regulations, yes, guiding the militia, but it wasn't a bunch of rules and regulations. It was well regulated, meaning that these people knew their job. So with that, I want to thank you for listening. You've been listening to Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shurtleff. And the show is heard on WBCQ The Planet. And until next week, may God bless you.